3 years is a tiny amount of time in the history of any organization. It would be the most selfish, vain, self-indulgent thing to think that I want people to talk. This is what Jarlath Burns did during his presidency. There's a number of things. You look at the issues that are facing the association and you address those during the time that you're there. And there is also a strategic plan. If you listen to the podcast you did with Stuart Kenny, formerly of Paddy Power, he said that one of his mentors said, don't even think 10 years, think 20 years ahead. And think of your grandchildren. That's the sort of vision that we have to have in the GAA.
The 41st president of the GAA has recently taken office. He's Jarlath Burns, who captained Armagh to an Ulster football title in 1999, then became an administrator at club, county, provincial and national level. He'll hold office for 3 years and he's on leave of absence from his job as principal of one of the biggest second-level schools in the country, St. Paul's in Bessbrook. Jarlath Burns, you are most welcome to the Insights podcast. Thank you indeed for joining us.
Grandma Hagertrum.
I'm fascinated to read that you intend to remain on as secretary of your club, Silver Bridge, while at the same time being ooked around coming to Luke Glasgow. I mean, you really are a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, if elected, Sean, we have an AGM every year, which you have to go up for election at. But I have signalled that intent because, well, firstly, I enjoy it. I love being secretary of my club. Gets you right into the heart of what it's like to be in a GAA club. It makes you relevant within the community. As well as that, I think it's important for the members to know that whenever the president stands up, he's not doing it from a position of aloofness, but that he's doing it from the position that, you know, Congress, all of those people in Congress are all very active in their own clubs, and it's important, I think, to see the president as one of them as opposed to somebody who's talking from high.
Yeah, there was a picture of you recently wearing a yellow jacket acting as steward, I think, at a match up in the Gaelic grounds in Armagh. Now, was that just done for show, a photo opportunity?
No, it certainly wasn't. The story behind that is that all Armagh clubs, because Armagh owns its own ground, we don't have the luxury of the local club providing all the stewards. So we had a problem with stewards, and when I was in the Armagh executive, he came up with the idea that every club has to provide two stewards. And I enjoy stewarding, but as well as that, when you have a son involved in the team, it's best to get away from the fancy seats where you might be shouting things or thinking things or saying things or hearing things. And I always try and bring myself to the part of the ground where nobody is at all. And I don't know who took that photograph. It was a long distance one. And I was surprised because I've stewarded all the games. I just don't know how that particular one got in.
I've heard it said that probably the best place of all to learn the art of politics is the GAA. The back rooms, the committees and all that, far better training ground than normal politics, if I can use that phrase, in county councils or the Dáil, whatever. What would you say to that?
Yes, and I certainly found that. I think the first time I went, I discovered why it was maybe 30 years since we had a president from the six counties as well, because it is very much, firstly, a political but a small p organisation. And then, obviously, because the GAA is very much linked with the community and it's the identity of the community, local politicians would see that it's valuable being involved with the GAA. So you have that in it as well. But that's just a part of it. But it's not something that you really think about in the day-to-day work that you have to do. But certainly when you're going for election, and I've stood for many elections in the GAA, you realise just how political it is.
But even though it's an all-Ireland organisation, a 32... county organisation. Might there have been an element of partitionism which maybe crept up on you and basically derailed your hopes the first time to win the presidency?
God, I couldn't possibly say that because I just think at the time that came, we were ready to embrace the idea that we are a global organisation, and Larry McCarthy was the person who was there from New York, standing for New York. And I know that whenever the results come in, although I was very disappointed for my club, and because there was hundreds of people from my club showed up that night, they all went home disappointed. I was really, really happy for the association that we had identified ourselves as a global organisation. And I was genuinely happy for Larry as well, because he's such a decent guy. And the two of us have become really good friends. And I think that as well as that, I probably wasn't ready for it 3 years ago. I don't think I had the ideas that I have now. I don't think they were fully formed. But now, a lot of people said that the first time I went around canvassing, Sean, I did a lot of talking. And the second time I went round, I did a lot of listening. And I think that maybe was the difference, that I listened more to what counties were saying.
An important lesson. Is the president of the GAA, is he like or she like the chairman of a board of directors? Or is there a comparator that you could make?
Well, there has to be, because you're the chair of the Cúisitigh Bainistíochta, which is the executive. And then you're also the chair of Ard Corlea Central Council, and you're the chair of the Croke Park Board too. So you do a lot of chairing of things. You also have all of the committees that really run the association. Gee, it's so lucky that we have so many volunteer people willing to serve in committees, and those committees do such incredible work for the GAA. And if we were to put all of that work that our committees do out to consultancy, it would cost us millions. We save millions because of that at the highest level, and we're very lucky to have it. But you are, while you don't want to be treading on the toes of the permanent staff, and particularly the Director General, the Archduke, Tom Ryan, who is in charge of the day-to-day running. And as well as that, we also have a strategic plan that you have to stick to as well. You can't be going off on tangents, but the President will always be entitled to have a couple of big projects that he will want. And I suppose that's what is really going to be the theme of my presidency.
One of the things you've been saying is that, you know, you've been mindful, you are mindful, and you've touched on this already, that there will always be a particular perspective on and expectation of a GAA president who comes from Northern Ireland, from the six counties. What do you mean by that?
Because in the North, identity is something which is disputed. The historical narrative is disputed. It's not particularly disputed in the South. And because the GAA is so tied up with our history and the history of Ireland, the history of the GAA, because the GAA is of the community where we all belong, as we say, in the North we have a disputed historical and political narrative. The GAA has very much been on one particular side of that. And we have always to be very careful how we tread, what we say, what we do. And the unionist population are easy to offend. And they get offended quite a lot, I have to say, and because they have something to defend, and that's the six counties. They are British and they're entitled to be British in this country. And I think the GAA in recent years, under the incredible leadership of Ulster GAA, the Ulster Council, have adopted almost a neutral position. And as a result of that, we have been able to expand into areas that you'd never have thought before. Like there's a GAA club in East Belfast, which is possibly our area of biggest growth, and in other areas as well. And I think that's possibly the most exciting thing now about the GAA.
And do you see that that process being one that will continue? I mean, could you envisage that there will be people in, you know, sort of the Protestant areas or the unionist areas of Portadown or wherever who will take up playing Gaelic football and hurling?
Well, we have always said in Armagh that we would love to see places like Hamilton Spawn, Rich Hill, you know, Portadown, even though there is a GAA and a hurling club in Portadown, and in fact the GAA hub is going to be in Portadown, our centre of excellence. We think that there is a whole vast area for the development of our potential in those areas. But it's going to be a challenge, because I remember Mark Conway from Tyrone telling us a story that whenever they were building the Centre of Excellence in Tyrone, and one of the things that they wanted to do on the historical wall was to find out how many young men from Tyrone died in the World Wars. So they went to the Royal British Legion to ask, and the Royal British Legion were very interested in this, and when they invited Mark into their hall in Omagh, he looked around, he couldn't get over all of the red, white and blue paraphernalia and the pictures of the Queen and pictures of British battalions and everything else. And whenever he reflected, he realised, hang on a minute, the clue is in the name, Royal British Legion. What do you expect to see in the Royal British Legion? Only this sort of stuff, because that's their identity, that's their culture. Similarly, the first letter of our association is Gaelic. We are very proud to be Irish, proud of our language, proud of our culture. And we know that that can cause controversy in the North. So that's why I believe that there will always be a particular perspective and idea from a Northern president. And that's why you have to be so careful in your language and so careful in how you embrace other people and other cultures.
As a school principal and administrator, you have been in a position to offer some classes and some tuition to students from non-Catholic schools. Yours is a Catholic school in Bessbrook, a very big one. How did that come about and what has been the effect of it?
Well, our school is one of the biggest in Ireland, I would say. We've never asked that question because it doesn't really mean anything if you're the biggest or the smallest. But also in South Armagh, just up the road from us, is Newtown Hamilton High School, which would be a Protestant school. There would only be about 150, 160 pupils there, and they were all, the sword of Damocles is always hanging over those small schools that we'll be waking up some morning and they'll all be gone. And there is a thing in the North where you have to offer so many subjects at GCSE and so many at A-level. Obviously a big school can do that, but smaller schools find it difficult. And there was a rumour a few years ago that schools that couldn't offer that, those number of subjects were going to be closed. So we came to an agreement with Newton Hamilton School that on a Thursday, our curricular offer would be open to GCSE and A-level, GCSE in particular, to that school if their pupils wanted to come down and do the subjects, with the result then that they were able to expand their offer. And as a result of that, our two schools have got very close. We do a lot of things together. And most of it, to be honest, is to do with going into places where we normally wouldn't go, going to Orange museums. For example, whenever the Museum of Orange Heritage Schomburgk House was opened, they invited us to it. And our school was the first school over the threshold on that day, on a day when that museum was opened by one Mary McAleese. So what we always find is that when you offer the hand of friendship, there'll always be somebody there to take it. And these are little things that go on in the North, particularly in the education system, that most people don't notice, or maybe within that particular narrative that they're not interested in. But it really works for us.
That is a different kind of portrayal and perspective on South Armagh than people might have been used to thinking about. I mean, it was seen as a byword for violent republicanism. Sniper at work would be a signpost you'd see on telephone poles going through there. What was it like for you to grow up in that environment?
It because it was normal, Sean, we never really passed any remarks. It was a very heavily militarised area. As well as that, there was always this sense that the entire armoury of the state was pointing against us, because the Northern Ireland state had no interest in people from South Armagh in the nationalist population. And you always just get the sense of fighting against the odds. And ironically, the thing which most defined us, which was the border, for many people became the saviour, because a lot of people just had to turn to smuggling, including my own father. Without that, we wouldn't have had anything.
What did he smuggle?
It was potatoes. For many, many years. And I can say that now because he's passed away, but there was hundreds of people were involved in that, and we used to go with him. And you would always be, that was the most fervent prayers you ever said whenever you would be stopped maybe about a mile from the border, either by the customs or the guards or the police. And we used to have a prayer. We used to say, "Infant Jesus lost and found, infant Jesus lost and found," as they were coming. And you would just feel so sorry for your daddy, because it'd be 12 and a half ton of potatoes.
Now, which direction was the smuggling going?
It was cheaper in the south than it was in the north. So we went from south to north.
And with the contraband,
with the illegal material. I don't even know if I should be saying this now, because it was shrouded so much in secrecy. But that's now part of our history. That's the '70s, and that's very much part of our history now.
Was he ever caught?
Oh yeah, he would have been caught. The customs would lift the lorry, and he would have to buy the whole thing back again. And that would be a massive setback. There would be just depression in our house. But genuinely, Sean, there was nothing else for us. There was nothing else for us to do in that area, in Craigan, where we lived. And if he hadn't done that, it was going to be the dole, because there was no industry in Newry, which is our local town, or in Cross Maglen, and we just had to make our own way.
And he had a big family to provide for.
Yes, there was 8 children, one of whom, Cormac, had spina bifida. And a lot of their time would have been going to Belfast with Cormac, quite a lot of complications early on in his life. And our granny, who lived with us, practically reared us, because my mum and dad would have been spending a lot of time going to Belfast with Cormac. And but again, all of that was natural to us, and it was just our life. And I look back, I had a happy childhood. I don't particularly think that it was any different to anybody else. It's only then, whenever you grow up and you look at what other people's childhood were like, you realise that it was, as the saying is, asan kachintacht. But that's why I owe the GAA so much, because the GAA was a sanctuary, and the local club was a place where you could go and you could be Irish and you could have your identity, and it was a safe space. It was a safe space unless the British Army decided for recreation they would land the helicopter in the field, which they did on many an occasion. And I think the people across Maglen deserve particular credit for how they showed resilience up against terrible, terrible intrusion. And it's no coincidence that Cross Maglen, I think it was a couple of years after the ceasefire, Cross Maglen won their first All-Ireland, because having that distraction of the British Army cheek by jowl with you had to have been a terrible disruption to the lives. And once that went, the cloud left Cross Maglen, and they began really realising their potential.
Did you ever consider or contemplate taking part in that Republican, violent Republican activity? Did you ever think about joining the IRA?
It was something that many of my friends did. But I'm going to be honest and say no. Because I knew always that I could never be involved in the taking of another person's life. That was always something that I could never contemplate. Whenever I looked and saw how hard we had fought to keep our Cormac alive, that's not out of any disrespect to anybody who took that choice or anybody who was in any army. It's just something that I know I could never do. And as well as that, because I could play football, I was always very, very busy with that. And that was always something to take me away from that. But many of my friends and relatives were involved. And in South Armagh, that was not unusual.
And would have been killed or shot or...
Yeah, I had a cousin, Brendan Burns, who was killed in a bomb. And that was an extremely sad time for our family, and particularly for his mother and father, Peter and Lily, my father's brother, Peter. They were just such decent, quiet people. And they had a terrible time during and after his death. And I remember Lily, his mother, got cancer shortly afterwards and died. And it was just such sadness and such unnecessary hassle for all of us being brought up in South Armagh.
Is it a particularly hopeful time for you now to be taking over the presidency just soon after the restoration of the power-sharing administration in Belfast at Stormont?
It is. And listening to the speeches on the first day back was such a wonderful thing for all of us. Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly, I just thought both of those women were inspirational. And the fact that the North is being led by two females now is wonderful as well. And as well as that, I think a lot has been learned by everybody that it is not a good idea to pull down institutions. Just keep them going, stay in. It doesn't matter what it is. Keep at it, and it will sort itself out. During the time that we haven't had a government, Northern Ireland has really ground to a halt. It's very, very difficult to do anything. Like even simple things like I drive an electric car, even finding, if you look at the infrastructure down here in comparison to in the north, it's just night and day. Roads, everything is different between the north and the south. And Brexit has just compounded all of that. So to see government, to see stability, that's what we want. Because when you're involved with the lives of young people, as I am, you're looking at children from age 11, the children from age 18, and you really, really yearn for them to have wonderful opportunities.
And is it going to make it easier or more achievable to redevelop Casement Park? It's a very big project. There's a clock ticking on it in the sense that they've got the European Championships in association football and soccer coming up in 2028 and five games scheduled to be played there.
Well, in the North, nothing is simple, nothing is straightforward. Everything, when it's involved, the GAA, as I said, will get pulled into the political arena. The three stadiums, if you just give a quick 2-minute history of that, we were supposed to have this Northern Ireland National Stadium at the Old Mays campus, and the three main sports were supposed to be involved in that, but the other two pulled out because it didn't really suit their needs. And then when the GAA were the last to pull out, we were told that we would get quite a share because we were going to stay with the project. And we decided that we wanted to upgrade Casement. And Casement has its own very tragic history. British Army took that over in the 70s and created a sanger out of it. And it was inaccessible. So the development of Casement was stunted as a result of the Troubles. Now it's very exciting. We're getting very, very close to it. And we just hope that we can get all of that money together and get the builders in and get that stadium built, which would be a fantastic beacon for West Belfast, a place that equally suffered. You know, when I lived in South Armagh, I went to college in St Mary's University College in West Belfast. So that was my entire childhood, South Armagh to West Belfast. And to see those two places now, they're unrecognisable. And it would just be brilliant to see Casement Park built and functional.
What about the financial numbers associated with it? We know how badly burned the GAA got in Cork with the redevelopment of Páirc Uí Chaoimh. There's still 30 million outstanding on it, and headquarters has to help the county board with that. It went way above budget. What's the story with Casement, and can it be controlled?
Yeah, well, a lot of the things are out of control when it comes to construction costs and when it comes to spiralling every type of cost that you can get between concrete and all of the other things. It's very hard to say. That's an imponderable. Stadiums everywhere are controversial projects. If you look, for example, go across the water to look at the rebuilding of Wembley Stadium, that went way, way over. The most recent one there was the Tottenham Hotspur White Hart Lane Stadium. That was supposed to cost 750 million. I think it ended up costing over $1.5 billion. And I just think that we have to be prepared to accept that. That's one of the things we accept. And it was the same in Cork. Looking back now, Cork did get a stadium at good value. Okay, there's a lot of debt in it. That will be resolved, I've no doubt about it. But we have other areas of infrastructure opening up. And as part of what did we do in the GAA, if we are bringing big crowds to watch our games, we have to do so in a way that our patrons, if we call them, or supporters, can do so in comfort in a modern world. Concrete seats and things like that are no longer acceptable for people going to the matches. It might have been okay for us, but not for the type of people who are going to watch games. And we do have a duty to make sure that people can watch games in comfort.
You have been quite emphatic, Jarlath Burns, that you have no interest in leaving a legacy as president of the GAA. Now, people listening to this may say, "Ah, oh, come on, of course he has. He just doesn't want to admit it."
No. Why? 3 years is a tiny amount of time in the history of any organisation. It would be the most selfish, vain, self-indulgent thing to think that I want people to talk. This is what Jarlath Burns did during his presidency. There's a number of things. You look at the issues that are facing the association and you address those during the time that you're there. And there is also a strategic plan. If you listen to the podcast you did with Stuart Kenny, formerly of Paddy Power, he said, one of his mentors said, don't even think 10 years, think 20 years ahead. Think of your grandchildren. That's the sort of vision that we have to have in the GAA. Otherwise, all we do is lurch from one bright idea
to
the
next. Well, here's the thought. Pat Spillane was writing about this in his column in the Sunday World recently at the start of the year, where he talked about three of your 40 predecessors left serious legacies. People like Peter Quinn, the development of the redevelopment of Croke Park, Sean Kelly, opening Croke Park to the playing of rugby and soccer, and the third one was a man who nurtured or mentored you, Sean McCaig, in lifting the ban on members of the security forces in the north playing Gaelic games. Now, wouldn't it be a fine legacy if Jarlath Burns could make Gaelic football more watchable?
Yeah, just see with regard to those three great men, I have to say, that I would look back with such fond memories of. But the one thing that the reason why they have left legacies was because there was a situation there that required courage and leadership. So in Peter Quinn's time, it was Croke Park that was there, and he had the courage at that time to say, there aren't five cranes over Dublin at the moment. Dublin is in a recession and a slump, but we are going to build our stadium. That was a brilliant decision because everything was cheaper then. We could never build Croke Park now. Same with Sean McCaig, Rule 21, because the political scenario at that stage required a decision to be made. Sean McCaig went and made it, and the same then with Sean Kelly with Rule 42, because Lansdowne Road was being redeveloped and a decision had to be made. So I am not going to try and contrive something to try and leave a legacy. But Gaelic football, again, 2025 is a rule change year in Congress. So what we have done is we have allowed, that means that a Congress, it's Wild West, if you go every 5 years, it's always very very entertaining, but it's not the way in which to change rules on the floor of Congress. So I have set up a football review committee led by Jim Gavin of Dublin fame. Some incredible people are on it as well, the likes of Eamon Fitzmaurice, Malachy O'Rourke, Colm Nally, who was with our club last year and for Kildare this year. And those guys are going to work over the next year at taking in all of the motions that have been submitted and really coming up with their own thoughts on the game, because they have been involved at a very high level. Colm Collins, when Clare, he has been one of the longest serving managers. When I contacted every single one of them, because that was the one committee that I had ready before Congress with the chair and with the terms of reference, with a vision, you name it, every single one of them said, yeah, I would be so honoured to do this. So there is no guarantee that the Gaelic football that will emerge from this process is going to be any nicer, any better, any more watchable. But I can tell you, I have put the best minds to this. And when I was standing committee on the playing rules chair, our group was responsible for bringing in the midfield mark, because we wanted to cherish the catch, high catch in the middle of the field. I think that has been achieved largely. If you catch a ball in the middle of the field now, you get that little bit of space and there's more of it. But I think just a wee bit more of that sort of thinking to just really preserve the special skills of the game of Gaelic football, that can be such a beautiful game when it's played correctly.
There are all sorts of ideas floating around about limiting the numbers who can be in any given half at any particular point of the match. But you talk about matches being refereeable. Now, again, and then putting a limit on the number of hand passes, I mean, it's hard enough to referee GAA matches as things are without making it even more onerous.
It is. And if you look at rugby, for example, it's a completely different game to referee because all of the players are usually around the referee. All of the play moves in the one area. When you're a Gaelic referee, and I referee all our club challenge matches for us, and it you know, you could be in the 21-yard line or the 14-yard line and then suddenly the ball moves up at play at three kicks and you have to sprint back up again. And not only are you sprinting, you're having to watch, eyes at the back of your head, everything that's going on. And very often in club matches, you also have, you know, six other officials who are partisan, the four umpires and the lines people. And they are not always going to give an honest appraisal of what's going on behind as well. So any change that you bring in as well, Sean, you have to remember, will this work in the last minute of an All-Ireland final? What will this look like? And secondly, what will it look like on a wet Tuesday night, Silverbridge reserves playing against Collyhanna with one referee? And one of the things that they may have to look at is a little bit of divergence from the county game to the club game, or from the club senior game to the underage game, to understand that, you know, we have to understand that referees in club league matches are on their own. They don't have the benefit of impartial linesmen and umpires. So all of those things are going to be in the mix.
It's, I think, at least a half a century since there was an experiment done with the rules and reducing the number on the pitch to 13 man instead of having 15 man teams. It'll be 15 girls and 15 boys, or the way things have changed. Is it time to look at that again?
That is something that has been spoken of quite a lot with regard to county panels recently. I've heard very eminent people talking about that, and it's very attractive from a number of perspectives. And one of the perspectives that have been told to me, that if you have 13 a side, it means you have smaller panels and smaller costs involved with county teams. We spent 40 million last year. It could be a lot more than that on preparing county panels, many of whom are really, really inflated. And that's something else that we have to address. But I am going to put my hands in the and my trust in this committee. And the way it works is they will provide an interim report for Ardcorda before the end of the year. And then in the new year, we will probably trial some of the rules, if they have any, with a view possibly to a special Congress in September to tidy it up. But these guys are taking this very seriously. Notwithstanding the brilliant work and evidence and data that has been gathered by the various standing committees on playing rules led by David Hassan over this past 6 years. And I'm very excited as to what they're going to propose.
Clearly, you do not want to prejudge or preempt what they may come up with, but do you believe that they can succeed in making Gaelic football more watchable?
Well, I will argue that it is very watchable in maybe 70% of games, and particularly at underage, where you don't have as many people behind the ball because the youngsters don't have the developed sense of the game to know that you have to do that. And very often, if you have a big fella in the middle of the field, he can burst through any blanket defence and you can see them playing well. But there are times when you watch the game and you just think, no, this is particularly the bit whenever the team is attacking and they reach that phalanx in the half forward line, Sean, and there's just no way through. So they're trying it through and then they come back and they channel the ball over to the other side and they're trying it through and you're looking at them going, we really have to try and do something to make it easier for a team to attack. Now, this will receive a lot of opposition from some managers. Like Mickey Hart will say, we have to change our perception on the game. We have to understand that good defending can be as attractive as good attacking. And shielding of the ball, blocking, all of those things can be as memorable. But most people would say, no, the most memorable points, if you look at the All-Stars, for example, the programme, and if you look at the clips that they show, they will show the most beautiful scores, the goals, the breaking through, all of those things, the high catches in midfield, and I suppose it's your job to try and amplify that as much as possible.
You touched on something there, Jarlath Burns, about the cost of maintaining panels and so forth. And I think one of the points you were making at the Congress was that, you know, the GAA will get far more value from the 32 million euro that JP McManus bestowed on the association to give to clubs than you get from the 40 million or so that's spent on inter-county team preparation.
Yes, if you remember when Limerick won that first All-Ireland, and we all got three, I think we got 3,500. We put that towards a generator in our club because we needed a generator at the time. And every time we put that generator on and it lights up our field, we thank JP McManus for doing it. And similarly, when that money, new money came along, I think it's 23,000 the clubs in Armagh have got each. We're putting an extension onto a resource centre, and that is literally buying the roof for that. And that's a fitness suite that's going to be in it for our senior team. And that will be there for 50 years. We look up at that and think that is the legacy of that. The money that we, I don't mean players aren't to blame for this. The GPA aren't to blame for this. We are to blame for this. The culture of the GAA at the high performance level is such that you look over the fence and see, what are they doing? Oh, if they're doing that, we have to do it, and we have to do it better. And that's all part of the human condition. It's even the same, I will argue, in weddings. You know, weddings have become almost inflated. You know, somebody looks at a wedding and they think they're after spending an extra 3,000 on that. Oh, I'm going to spend 4,000 on mine. And I think that that's part of the human condition, particularly in areas of high performance. And we are the administrators, and there is no financial ceiling at the moment on what we spend on the preparation of our county teams. And there should be, because as a result of the money that we are spending on the size of county panels, the number of training sessions, the number of people we have in our backroom teams, it is impacting on other areas of the GAA, particularly the upkeep of our stadiums and things like that. And I just think we have to find a balance. So I have another work group, the Amateur Status Committee. The last time this was done was in 1997. That's going to take a look at what is it like to be an amateur player, an amateur athlete playing GAA in 2024. What is realistic within busy lifestyles for young men getting married, having their lives, having children, and able to balance that with playing county. At the moment, our players are professional in everything but name. The entire game around them has become professional in that we have major sponsorship, big crowds going to matches, all matches on television, but the players are still not being paid. Of course, that situation could never change. We have to change around it to make the game more accessible to our best players, that it means that they are not spending all their lives training and playing and thinking about the game and having to mind themselves, but that they can have some form of spare time for themselves and their families.
How could you possibly go about changing that, or, you know, reversing that? Because, again, they've got to train at 6 o'clock in the morning, 6 days a week, and have a match then as well, or two matches, whatever it would be. It's very hard to roll back from that.
It is, but we have to. So even across the water in the ultra rich Premier League, they have financial ceilings. We all know that Everton lost 10 points because they went above their budget. Chelsea would love to get rid of their manager, but they can't, because if they know they would have to pay out his contract and they would have to pay another man, that would put them beyond their budget. But in the GAA, which is has amateur status as one of our six values, we don't have that. And as a result of that, you know, we're all involved in this rat race to try and just find that little thing that's going to make the difference and get us across the line. And actually, one of the things that I can never understand, that's one of the simplest things with all of this training that they're doing, that would make such a massive difference to players, is that we should be cultivating players to play with both feet in football. The moment you do that, you turn a player's prospects and options on the field. I don't see as much of that sort of thinking, but I see more of, you know, more training, longer training sessions, going away to more places, going to warm weather training, all of that stuff. I was listening to Jim Gavin there recently talking at an event that I was at, and he said he never did that with Dublin. Contrary to popular belief, Dublin didn't spend that much money on preparing their county teams, and he never took them away to warm weather climes to prepare, and he never did all of the things that we see with other teams. But
mind you, I do recall bumping into a bunch of them in Valderrama, but that was probably before Jim Gavin's time.
Possibly so, yeah.
That might have been in the Pat Gilroy era, but nonetheless, a related matter though is the question of, you know, another attack on the amateur status. I mean, more honoured arguably in the breach than the observance, the under the counter payments to managers, be it at county or club level. And one of your predecessors, the aforementioned Peter Quinn, famously making the observation, we couldn't even find the table, let alone the payments going on underneath it. I mean, is that another lost battle?
Well, you could find the table now. The life has changed immeasurably since then, because governance has become a massive issue within all organisations, and particularly in the GAA. And you know, audit and risk is a very, and governance is very, very important. And RTE and all of the other big organisations of state have learned that as well. We're trying to be ahead of that in the GAA and understand that if we are going to go down the road of the amateur status, that's a decision that we have to make. Now, I will say this, you would be surprised by the number of county managers who are still unpaid. You'd be very, very surprised. I would say more than half of them are still doing it just for basic expenses and actually costing them money. And if you are bringing somebody in from outside who is not your county manager, it is understandable why they would be looking for recompense. And my idea in this is, let's not be hypocritical. Let's not be two-faced about it. If we feel that we have to pay managers, well, let's have a conversation. Let's have an honest conversation about it. Let's not be pretending that it doesn't exist. Let's ask our managers, would it help that if we did put you under a contract and instead of you getting a few backhanders from the sponsor or from somebody wealthy in your county, see, can maybe the GAA look after this in a way that is honest and that takes into consideration, you know, revenue obligations that we have? Because the GAA is still one of the organisations that are looked up to as doing our affairs correctly and having integrity. But not really in this matter. And that's something that does cause me anxiety at times. And I think that the Amateur Status Committee will probably make a decision on that. And I'd like to think it'll be an imaginative one.
In other words, that it will allow, if you like, the situation, the de facto, to become the de jure.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, Sean.
What then about the situation in regard to paying club managers? Again, they're extending themselves in some instances, maybe more than some, to get a trainer or a coach, a manager who can lead them on to great success.
That's a much more difficult one to deal with. A lot of clubs do it. A lot of clubs have to do it, because if you look at the dynamic of a club and people up and down the country who are involved in running their clubs, this will chime with them. You have your own managers for 3 or 4 years, and after a while, you run out of people within the club to do it, and you do need a new voice. Because very often within clubs, there will always be the people who will say, oh yeah, he's always going to get picked, and that family there, they're always going to be looked after, and we need somebody brand new to come in with a new eye. And we did that actually last year. We brought in Colm Lally from Meath, and he was an absolutely brilliant manager. He started playing lads that we would never really have thought of down through the years, because when you've watched people come through the underage, you always see that this wee fault, and those lads prospered. So it can be novel for a club to bring in what we call an outside man. It goes against our values, but I understand the practicalities and the rationale for doing it. And again, that is something that we might very well have to look at in the future.
With or without payment?
Well, that would be up to the committee that I have commissioned.
You are reposing enormous faith in these committees that you've set up are in the course of getting on the job. Another one you're setting up is one called Tamanch,
yes.
Which I think is the Irish word for driving, but it also is adding the word tea onto the word imanch, hurling. Again, you've made the point that you come from a place that is not a hurling stronghold, but you've been working on that.
I never got a chance to play hurling. I absolutely love hurling. My wife is from West Belfast. She came from a hurling background. But all my children have played hurling. And a very proud moment for us, I think it was 4 years ago, when Fionnuala won an Ulster hurling All-Star. And Creve Rua, the club that they play for, won the Ulster and were beaten by Fulham Gaels in the quarterfinal of the All-Ireland in Park na hÉireann in Birmingham. I think that I am in a unique position, having understood, coming from a football background, the struggle that exists to try and develop hurling in non-hurling areas. And we can talk for hours about hurling, but I would say a number of things. Firstly, it is wrong to say that hurling is in a bad place. Hurling is in a fantastic place at the moment. There are more people playing hurling than ever before, more children playing hurling than ever before, more, let's say, junior hurling clubs around all of the counties than ever before. We've had more hurling All-Ireland winners in the last 10 years than football. But all of that could be seen as just spin that is masking the fact that the prairie fire that Cusack talked about that swept the country at the onset of 1884 and the founding of the GAA did not extend to hurling. And if you draw a line from Dublin to Castlebar, north of that, it's very scant in places. And probably the biggest barrier to the development of hurling is Gaelic football. Because there's a fear factor that if you set up a hurling club, it'll affect the chances of winning at football and distract the boys. Now,
they're nodding in Kilkenny.
Well,
on a reverse kind of psychology there.
Yeah, absolutely, and fair play to them. But what I would say is that, again, look at long term, Sean. Let's forget about legacy, forget about 3 years. I'm talking about 20, 25 years. Armagh, for example, is never going to win a Liam McCarthy as long as we have only 8 clubs. We should have 18 clubs. There should be about 7 hurling clubs in South Armagh. We have one.
How doable then is that expansion?
Well, I think what I would say is that the focus of and remit of this committee, many and the members of this committee are different to other hurling development committees in that they come from those counties. They have set up clubs in areas where it has been difficult to do so. So they know the challenges and they know the barriers. I think that we need to make it easier for those who want to develop hurling within the clubs or to set up hurling clubs. It's not an easy task to set up a GAA club. You have to have your county fees, you have to have your insurance fees, you have to have a ground, you have to have sticks, you have to have helmets. There's just so many things that you have to consider. And I think that if we make it easy for clubs to set up a hurling club by providing coaches, providing advice, providing case studies. So one of the things I would like them to do is to set up, you know, a hurling club toolkit containing case studies of people who have done so. And I've spoken to so many people who have done this successfully. And I think that that's where we need, it's a slow burner.
Yeah,
that's where we need to be going, the development of new hurling clubs.
But recently there was this proposal which generated a lot of controversy. My colleague and friend Damien Lawler reported it on RT Sport. There were 5 counties. It was proposed that effectively they stood down as hurling entities: Cavan, Longford, Louth, Leitrim and Fermanagh. Now, why would that happen? And might it actually be a case of, well, you need to go back before you can go forward?
I'm glad to be able to explain exactly the narrative of what happened and how, at a time that is quiet in GAA activity, which is October, November, something like this can become almost as big as the Whistles event that happened in the Father Ted series. Every couple of months, the CCCC, the Central Competitions Control Committee, will come with proposals to Central Council, which are to do with discussions that they have with counties. One of them, for example, recently was whether or not, for example, we should have National League finals. You would save a weekend there for preparation for the championship, and we voted against that. So there's these little suggestions are coming all the time, and it's always happened. And that came about from CCCC meeting the treasurers, actually, and those counties saying, look, we are spending so much on the league in hurling that it might have been better, instead of us participating in the league, that if we expand the Laurie Maher Cup, that would give us more meaningful games. Because one of the proposals of the last hurling development was to try and create regional centres where it is easier and more facilitative to play challenge matches and to play games. Because for Antrim trying to perform, if they want a meaningful challenge game, they have to travel to Kilkenny or Dublin. I mean, it's very, very difficult for Antrim and to do such great work. So really what they were saying was, A, to expand the Laurie Maher and take these counties out of the National League and use the money that is being spent on preparing those teams to develop grassroots hurling in those counties. That was a proposal in November, to come back to the December meeting for ratification, go back to your counties, it's only a proposal. All hell broke loose in that intervening month. It was only a proposal. It raised eyebrows at Central Council. We all said, yeah, we'll go back and we'll talk about it and we'll see what the individual counties think. I contacted personally all of those counties. They said, look, all of these things were done in good faith, but we see now that there's this movement against it. And it came to the next meeting of Ard Corla and we voted against it unanimously. But unfortunately, the residual legacy of that is that there would be people who would say, oh, look at the GAA, they're having a clue up there in Croke Park. Sure, didn't they want to take some of the smaller counties and not allow them to play hurling at all? That is almost insulting, because firstly, it is unbalanced. It doesn't consider the facts of exactly what happened. and that the GAA will always have to be looking at imaginative ways of developing our UNESCO heritage game of hurling. And not, as some people would say, throwing good money after bad. But when you listen to the interview recently given by the Fermanagh manager about he had a stroke just a couple of weeks ago and he got out because hurling keeps him going. And when you listen to what it means to people from those counties, of course we're not going to take them out of the National League. And the decision to do so didn't come from Croke Park. It came from some people within those counties themselves. And not from which an anti-hurling perspective.
Which would suggest that there are people in high positions in county boards who don't really care enough about hurling.
Absolutely not. It's the absolute opposite. What they said was that if we took that money, and remember what I said, what the Chumunch initiative is, if we want to be getting these counties performing cheek by jowl with the Kilkennys and the Tipperarys, it's a long-term project. We need to be spending the money on developing grassroots hurling. And that's what they're doing very successfully in places like Fermanagh and Tyrone and Donegal. I mean, there are some fantastic hurlers coming through. I speak to Humphrey Kelleher and he will say that if you took the best hurlers between Donegal, Cavan, Fermanagh and a few of these, you know, Mayo, and formed them into a regional team to play, that they could, there's hurlers in those teams that could beat any of the top county teams. And again, going back to the Hurling Development Committee, the Liam Sheedy one, one of the things that they said was give opportunities to hurlers to play hurling in meaningful games. And I think we've done that really, really well. So we don't have to throw all of those ideas out. We just move to the next stage, which is develop new clubs and develop us further in the schools. And I think that's what has to be the long-term project for hurling.
Something else you have committed to is the completion of this objective, or the achievement of it, of merging the GAA with the Ladies Gaelic Football Association and the Camogie Association. Mary McAleese is chairing that. One gets the sense that it's not going anywhere fast.
That, absolutely not. What we are doing is we want to make sure that before we press that button, that we have everything in place and that we know what we're doing. It's very easy at club. Like, the vast majority of clubs operate the one club model, including our own club. And it has improved clubs immeasurably, bringing ladies in and getting all of those ideas that they have. At county level, it's different because you're into the whole area then of finance and then facilities. I think that it would be a council of despair if we think that we can't do this. Working in a school where there's so many strong female older students who will badger me constantly and say, Mr. Burns, you have to make sure that you do this. I feel there is an obligation on us to do it. And that I really look forward to the organisation that's going to emerge from this. But the one thing...
Will it happen during your presidency?
I doubt it. I'm going to be honest. I don't think it will. And again, I'm not ego-driven. I don't think that it should be necessarily on my CV that I am the person who did it. And it wouldn't be my achievement
why
any.
Why wouldn't it happen over a three-year
Well, it wouldn't
period.
Be my achievement any because it would be achievement of Mary McAleese and all of the associations to create the circumstances whereby it can happen. There's just a lot of groundwork to be done around the specifics, for example, of where within each individual county. Some counties, for example, operate hurling and football in one executive committee, depending on their bylaw. Others have the hurling or the football as a subcommittee of their main committee. And I suppose it's trying to find out where all of these entities would exist within, for example, a central competitions control committee within each county, with the hearings, with disciplinary, with facilities, with county teams, expenses, all of those things. We just want to get that right. And it might very well happen, but if it doesn't, it will be for the right reasons.
It's clear that you regard the GAA as fundamental, if you like, driving force and force for good and stability in Irish society. But there are problems within society. I mean, one thinks particularly, say, of the area of drugs. It's not just every town, it's every village now. Cocaine is easily accessible. Is there a role for the GAA in that, or is it something that, you know, is on your mind as well as being a GAA man, being a school principal as well?
It is, of course. And when you spend your life in the company of young people, you have a really heightened sense of the challenges that they face. And even I know that 10 years ago, if you said, what was the problem within young people? What is the thing that they worry about most? It was self-esteem. But now it's anxiety. And there are many ways, some artificial, some non-so, of dealing with anxiety. And unfortunately, many of our young people are turning to cocaine and to other drugs and to gambling as well. These are all societal issues. The GAA doesn't have the solution to any of these, but we certainly can use our influence within society. For example, last year we did a series of courses over winter for our young men over a series of weeks. Week one was One Punch Can Kill. Week two was consent. You know, week three was CPR, and week four was dealing with drugs. And the GAA's health and wellbeing arm is something that is very well developed and is doing incredible work. And again, as a driver of decency and integrity within the communities, the GAA has a massive role to play. And I think we play that role really well. And it's unsung. There are people up and down the country doing things within their clubs and within their counties that are just incredible to help young people. And I actually remember a few years ago going into Garnerville, which was the PSNI training place, as part of their cultural relations module that the young recruits do. And there was myself and there was a guy from the Orange Order, a guy from the Royal Black, and somebody from the Irish language, and we were all giving talks. And at the end of it, the fellow who was in charge of that, the senior PSNI guy, actually, I was surprised whenever the questions came in that I got very few questions from them. It was mostly aimed at the other guys, and a lot of it was quite antagonistic at times. And I said to the superintendent at the end, I'm surprised that me as a GAA person, I didn't get much of a grilling from them. And he said, we know that when we go into places like Cross McGowan or Galbally or Culleland or Dungannon and these nationalist towns, if there is a strong GAA in those places, we won't have any trouble with the young men, because the GAA will give them purpose and a focus and something to do, and there will be an arm around them, and it's a sanctuary for them to do. In places where there is no strong GAA set up and no community, that's where you have this sense of nihilism amongst these young lads, and then they start turning to more destructive things. That really struck me as something that had been unsaid by ourselves and by society in Ireland, and it took somebody from the PSNI to really open my eyes on that. So the GAA always plays an incredible role within the communities and helping communities, because we understand our young people in a very unique way.
Would the same be applied, say, to where drink is concerned as opposed to drugs?
Yeah, it is, of course.
Hard times for some clubs getting teams out maybe on a Sunday because they've been out so late and indulging on a Saturday night.
Not as much as you might think there. It's actually really the opposite. I'm a very proud member of the Pioneer Total Absence Association, and it's something that I'm very, very proud of, and I promote as much as possible.
Has it been good for you personally?
Oh, the best decision I've ever made, I would say, outside of marrying Suzanne and having my family. It definitely is. I've met so many people who have regretted the first drink they ever took, but I've never met anybody who has regretted being a pioneer. And it has served me so well. I played my last game for Silverbridge aged 52 in the reserve championship. Now, I'm not saying it a good game. My wife at the end of it said, you need to knock that on the head. They're now laughing at you. And I did. But I would never have been able to go so long if I had been taking alcohol. But the difficulty is not so much people drinking before matches. It's drink bans. Drink bans, I am totally against drink bans. Because what happens is lads go off drink for 5-6 weeks or maybe 3 or 4 months. And then when it's all over, they go on a big binge. It's binge drinking is the problem. If we could have a culture where lads can have a few glasses of wine or go out for a night and have maybe a few too many, so what? That's okay. That's part of enjoying alcohol. I have a serious issue with drink bans.
Going back, though, Charlotte, to your decision initially not to drink, what drove that? I mean, had you seen horror stories maybe on the wider family tree or in the locality or wherever?
No. It wasn't really. I had a very inspirational primary 7 teacher who was also the principal of my school, Hugh McCauley. Probably one of the most influential people in my entire life, because it was he who introduced me to the Irish language and gave me that love as well. I remember he, for confirmation in primary 7, he did 5 or 6 weeks where he talked about alcohol and the dangers of it. And I remember him saying about alcoholism and that you would never know you're an alcoholic until you take your first drink. And I know that I have a very addictive type of personality. And even back then, I knew that I couldn't trust myself to take that drink or even gamble, any of those things. I try and stay away from them because I know that if I did, there's a good chance that the addictive personality that I have, that I wouldn't be able to control myself doing it. So I know my limits. As well as that, when I got older and I started playing Fermanagh, I knew I wasn't as fast or as fit as a lot of the people around me. And in order to give me that edge, that I'd be better stay away from alcohol. And as I've got older, I would never dream of, it's not something that I would ever, ever think of wanting to do. I don't think I've ever lost out 1 minute of happiness or enjoyment that I've never drank.
How big a wrench has it been for you to take yourself out of running St. Paul's in Bessbrook? I mean, is it a wrench?
'Tis massive wrench. 34 years there being involved in St Paul's, and then the last 10 has been principal. It's my local school. It's only 6 miles. It's non-selective, boys and girls. All human life is in there. It's an incredible place to work in. You just could not get a better place to work in. And I really, really hope to go back and finish my career in it when I'm finished. But I know Suzanne over Christmas could see that I was very unsettled, that I wasn't going back. And she went behind my back and booked a week in Lanzarote. And on the first day back in school, we were in Lanzarote. And I had my phone open on the WhatsApp for senior management. And I had my laptop, my iPad open on the cameras in the school. And I was watching stuff happening and texting. When you think about it, the SLT saying, because it was a very wet, it was a slippery day. And there was people slipping coming in. We need to get salt here. We need to do this. And Suzanne just came in and she closed the iPad. And she put the phone in and she just get up there to the pool. So it is difficult. I do pop in from time to time to the school, and it will always be very much part of my DNA, St Paul's Bessbrook.
GAA Go, they're complaining in Cork and elsewhere about putting three of their championship matches again in hurling behind the paywall. Do you have a view on that? Again, it's been proven to be quite controversial, this joint effort initiative between the GAA and RTE.
And I would just love if we had three or four broadcasters who were vying for our games. We don't. We used to have Sky. We used to have TV3. We don't. Fair play to RTE. They are always there for us and they're a great broadcast partner. But because RTE is a public service broadcaster, they can only show so many games. And that's correct, because they have to be able to show other things like drama, like the arts, like movies, like all of those things. So it's either RTE show these games or they are not on at all. And GAA Go, I suppose, was a compromise. It's very visionary. I know that perhaps the technology isn't just ready yet in some places, but I hope and I urge government to make sure that all of these places in 2024 have broadband capable of taking a basic streaming service. An awful lot of our counties are raising quite a lot of funds by streaming championship matches. It is the future in many respects, and I do think it's a great idea in the absence of another broadcaster taking on our games, or RTE not being able to. And of course, the unsung hero in all of this is TG Cahir, the Magenta Brodul, as TG Cahir, agus an doi a tashit abelta, na clihi a creelu, agus na clihi nachwil ho hinaihinta, a creelu a rihna blena. And I've been very proud to be involved with TG Cahir for many years as well. So for the championship, it would just be great if we had more choice. But I think that GAA Go is a great solution. And remember, Sean, this is important, that all the revenue we bring in goes back into our clubs. 87p, I think, in every pound or in every euro goes back to our clubs. So we don't have shareholders in the GAA. We have stakeholders. And our stakeholders get our money, our clubs, our counties, or, you know, the place where we need it. So if we are generating revenue through GAA Go, it's revenue for clubs and for schools and for all of the places where we want to develop the game.
And last word, grandfatherhood.
Yeah, they say that grandchildren get on well with their grandparents because they share a common enemy. Vlahin came along, or Megan is married to Dee O'Keefe, who plays hurling for Wexford. She was actually born between the two quarterfinals in Croke Park when Armagh were going out to play Monaghan. So we had a choice, either run over to Temple Street Hospital where she had been born, or watch Charlie Oak play for Armagh against Monaghan. So we stayed in Croke Park and we raced over then when it was over. And it has just been such a blessing. It's an incredible gift. Think when you're bringing up your own children, there's times that you, because you're so focused on all of the fundamentals of bringing a child and keeping them alive and getting them fed and getting them transported here and there and sleeping and everything else, there's sometimes you lose the magic of them actually being there. But as a grandparent, you just see it all. You see the beauty. And whenever Megan sends us videos of Blaheen in her development and doing little things, I watch them 100 times and I just watch every single moment of it. And only people who have experienced grandfather or grandmotherhood can understand what it's like, but it is really, really special.
I'm nodding in agreement. Jarlath Burns, thank you so much indeed for your time and your insights as you embark on your term as President. Uachtarán Cumann Lú Tlascoil, Gáinéirí Leat.
Gáinéirí Leat, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.